Hi there, and thank you very much.
Hey, Joseph Dane, KPFT.
Here in Houston.
Hey, Alex Steinberg, WBAI.
Present.
Tony Leon is present, WPFW. For the affiliate, Ifea Nwangaza is no longer with us, correct?
Right. It's Robin. Robin is now the new affiliate representative.
Okay. Robin, what's Robin's last name?
Robin Collier. I'm present.
Collier?
Yeah.
Collier.
Collier. Thank you. Thank you. Maxie Jackson, executive director.
Present.
Nancy Sorden, chair, PNB. Nancy Sorden?
She's muted.
I'll come back to her. Jan Goodman, I saw an email saying that she would be absent tonight. Tom Voorhees?
Here.
Okay, Tom Voorhees. We'll go back to Nancy Sorden. I think Nancy will be joining us. She was on earlier.
Yes, she was.
That is quorum. I believe we can have a meeting.
Thank you, Tony. Okay, I sent out a draft agenda, and let me read it for the benefit of those listening. Number one was roll call. We just did that. Point number two is agenda approval, for which we're allocating 10 minutes. Item number three are minutes, for which we're allocating 5 minutes. Item number four is a discussion of continuing discussion about affiliate, for which we're allocating 30 minutes. Item number five is a report from Greater Public CEO Joyce McDonald, and that'll be followed by a Q&A from Joyce McDonald, and that's a 45-minute item, and that will start precisely at 9 p.m. because that's when she was told to get on the call, so that we might actually get to that agenda item before we get to item number four, the affiliates. Probably we will at this point, I think. Item number six is new business, 10 minutes, and we're set to adjourn at 10:30. Do we have a motion to approve the agenda?
Motion to approve the agenda, I'm sure.
Are you going to, this is Maxie to the staff. Are you going to change the order of items number four and five?
Well, yes, because item number five is time certain for 9 p.m., and it's like a few minutes before 9.
Right.
So we will definitely be doing that item. I thought we'd have a little time before we got to that item, but we don't. So, yeah. Okay, are there any amendments or objections to the agenda? Okay, seeing none, the agenda is approved by acclamation. So let's go on. Do we have some minutes to approve? Hopefully we do.
Mr. Chair, this is Tony. The last meeting I attended was January the 15th.
Okay.
And I don't recall if we made quorum that meeting. Do you remember?
I believe we did.
Okay. So if that's the case, I'll forward the minutes to that meeting. And I believe Nancy might have some minutes from previous meetings, as I recall.
Yeah, and there's actually one set of minutes that I owe as well. I don't remember what meeting that is. I'd have to look that one up. Okay, so we don't actually have any minutes to approve tonight.
Carol for the stack.
Carol?
I just wanted to indicate that we had promised the auditors that we would do work to try and be up on the minutes this year, and I had promised the audit committee that I would be bugging people about minutes, and so consider yourself bugged. Thanks.
Okay, so let's make a very clear resolution that whoever did minutes, and I think I was one of the culprits, and then Tony volunteered once or twice, and Nancy had been doing it on a regular basis, but she's gotten very busy. Let's make a resolution that we'll get the minutes ready, prepared for the next and approved by the next meeting.
Can we have them ready by this Friday? Today's only Monday.
Let's just do the next meeting.
We're not meeting this Friday, so how we have to have a meeting to approve them.
We can do them via email, just because to catch up and to get the audits rolling.
Well, if we do them at the next meeting, that'll be great, Mansoor, but thank you for your enthusiasm.
Yep. I agree.
My stress. And
all right. Well, then I think we might as well go on to the next item. Maxie, is Ms. McDonald on the call? I realize it's 5 minutes earlier than we scheduled.
No, I don't believe they're on yet. I gave them the contact information, but I don't think they're going to call until 9 o'clock exactly. If you'd like, I can set up this presentation a little bit and give a little bit of detail, since it appears that there are some members of this call who weren't aware that we've joined Greater Public.
Okay, yeah, why don't we do that? Let's get a little orientation first, and then...
Okay.
So go ahead. The floor is yours.
Since this is a public call, I won't give out financial details in particular, but what I will say is that the general managers of all the Pacifica stations, the executive directors, I guess, of the units, were presented material about Greater Public. And as a result, all opted in on membership for the various Pacifica units. And so our membership is a group buy for 7 Pacifica units at a very good cost point. And so we have been members for, I think, about 2 weeks now. A little bit of background on Greater Public. Greater Public used to be known as Development Exchange Incorporated. They are and have been for quite a while the expertise in the non-commercial public service media industry regarding revenue centers, marketing, and management expertise in the field. They do a public media and development and marketing conference every year. It is highly attended, is considered the premier conference of the industry. This year's conference is July 9th through the 12th in Dallas, Texas. Many of our general managers and some development directors, where applicable, are planning to attend, or at least have expressed desire to attend. I used to serve on the board of directors for Greater Public years ago when they were known as Development Exchange Incorporated. I was on their board for 6 years. Pretty early on in my career. Joyce McDonald, who is going to speak to us today, is the president and CEO. She has been in that position a little over a year, I believe. And she'll be joined tonight by a woman by the name of Melanie Colson, who is the executive director of Member Station Services. So the way their operation works, and you can go to their website, greaterpublic.org, they have several consultants, experts in the field, who cover all the different revenue generation centers that a radio station would have. Shouldn't even limit it to radio. It's really about their services expand beyond radio to television as well, dual licenses, and they've, of course, gotten into new media and the like. In reaching out to Joyce to inquire about membership for Greater Public, she gave me a bunch of information. Like I said, I shared with the station manager, so they were well informed of the services that were being offered and the reputation of the organization. As a result of us joining, the Greater Public folks have promised to do four things on our behalf in the short term as sort of an onboarding process, and this call is part of that. So the first thing that they promised to do is record a webinar for Pacifica member stations, our stations, letting them know about all the available resources through Greater Public membership. And that's going to be a recording that they can share with staff members in the revenue centers at their stations. The second item that Greater Public will be doing on our behalf is conducting live webinars for our staff, the Pacifica staff, that will feature at least one of their professional membership advisors offering best practices and answering questions regarding pledge drives, membership campaigns, and the like. That will happen in March or early April. There's also been discussion about, for a certain amount of time, them doing a series of webinars to demonstrate to our specific Pacifica units ways that they can enhance their revenue centers. So this involves everything from membership and pledge to major donor, cultivation, and the like. Hopefully that's Joyce joining us.
Yes.
And Melanie.
Hey, Joyce is here.
Okay, great. Thanks
Melanie
for joining, guys.
Here.
I'm great, Melanie. I'm just setting you guys up, telling everybody about some of the things you suggested you'll do on our behalf as sort of an onboarding. And I've given a little bit of your background. So I was just killing a little time before you guys arrived, so I'm glad you're here. The last thing I'll say, they'll be doing two presentations. This one tonight for the Strategic Planning Committee. It's more focused on a subject matter that we've talked about before, and that is underwriting. And then they'll be talking to the Pacifica National Board, the entire board, on Thursday, giving them an overview of all of the services provided through Greater Public membership. So without further ado, unless, Alex, you've got something you want to add, I will yield the floor to Joyce McDonald, President and CEO, and Melanie Colson, Executive Director of Member Station Services of Greater Public.
No, I don't have anything to add. I just want to welcome you both to the Strategic Planning Committee of the Pacifica National Board, and we're anxious to hear from you, and go ahead. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much. We are very happy to be speaking with all of you, and thank you very much, Maxie and Alex, for having us join you this evening. First thing I want to say is that we are absolutely thrilled that the Pacifica Group has joined Greater Public. For background, Greater Public has existed since 1982.
Do you mind to introduce yourself, please?
Oh, certainly. This is Joyce McDonald, President and CEO of Greater Public. So Greater Public has been around. It was formerly called the Development Exchange since 1982, and we are an independent 501c3. Our only agenda is to support our member organizations in achieving their goals and fulfilling their mission. We have grown over the years to currently around 250 members, which, as Maxie was saying, consist of non-commercial radio stations and joint radio TV licensees. And those organizations range from community licensees in small communities to major market stations like yourselves, and pretty much everyone in between. We primarily support fundraisers and marketers, we support them in several ways, in developing strategies and in their day-to-day work. We are firmly convinced that the folks that are fundraisers and marketers are critical to sustaining their organizations, and also critical to creating a margin for investment in the mission. So how do we provide this support? We provide skills development opportunities, tools, methods, and as Maxie was saying, and by sharing best practices. And I know we have a conversation scheduled for the full board next week, and we'll go into more detail about our services and the benefits that come from membership. As Maxie said, tonight we're focusing on an overview of underwriting in non-commercial media. We welcome your questions as we go, and I will now hand the mic to Melanie Colson.
Well, hi, everyone. Thank you for having us, and we're just, again, as Joyce said, we're just really thrilled to have the Pacifica Network of Stations joining Greater Public. We love our members. We love working for our members. We spend a lot of time thinking about how to help them raise money and, in turn, better support their members and listeners. So anytime we grow and have new groups, it's just really exciting to us. So thanks again for the opportunity. So just wanted to give you some background about underwriting in non-commercial and public media. And like Dre said, we can take your questions as we go. So non-commercial stations across the country have pursued underwriting, local underwriting, as a part of their efforts to grow and diversify their mission for quite a while now. It really took hold, I would say, in the mid to late 90s, where stations realized that they needed to find new ways and more diverse ways to reach deeper into their communities. So that really was sort of the draw of it, so to diversify the revenue and support they were receiving. Underwriting is often the second largest source of financial support for local stations, behind individual donations, so like membership drives. In the latest numbers we found in fiscal year 17, local underwriting accounted for about 18% of station revenues, and that was behind individual donations at 38%, but ahead of local, state, or government funding at 4%. So that's kind of the breakdown of how it fits into the pie. Most underwriters are local businesses, nonprofit or community organizations. The top categories for underwriters for non-commercial radio stations include education, performing arts and entertainment, other nonprofits, retail, healthcare, and financial services are the main ones. So what do underwriters get as being part of the support mix for a station? Among other things, they are aligning themselves with a local, mission-driven, community-minded organization like non-commercial radio. Local businesses and community organizations are seen as caring about the community when they are a part of it. And it also offers them something that we refer to as the halo effect, whereby the positive qualities listeners attribute to the station, the radio station, transfer to the underwriter by association. So this helps build brand trust and loyalty for these local businesses, as well as drives purchase preferences. And for the stations, in addition to the revenue that would otherwise be left on the table, the station is in a position to amplify their brand and message, and also align themselves with community orgs, and thereby collectively kind of lift the economy and make things stronger among the immediate community. So those are kind of the broad strokes about that. we're just how public radio or non-commercial radio is distinguishing itself from other types of media. And so the FCC, of course, regulates non-commercial radio in the U.S. And enforcement on the broadcast of quote-unquote advertisements on non-commercial stations is one of their responsibilities. So they have a set of guidelines that stations must follow. And on top of that, stations also often have their own local guidelines that they often add to the mix as well, which can be a tighter than the traditional guideline or than the FCC guidelines. So there's lots of layers of support or ways that create firewalls between those entities. So any questions so far?
This is Nancy. I just wanted to say that I'm back. Sorry, I had a slight emergency.
Okay. So here's just a kind of an outline of some of the guidelines the FCC requires. Stations are allowed to identify but not promote commercial entities that provide general support for the station. Promotional language such as price, call to action, inducements to sell, comparative or qualitative information is not allowed. Political underwriting is not allowed. Stations are permitted to turn away an underwriter at their discretion. In other words, if the on-air announcements of an underwriter may adversely affect the station's revenue by causing other donors not to contribute, the station can refuse that underwriter's support and not air its credits. So the station has control over those things. And then, as I mentioned, you know, local guidelines are a big piece of this as well. As Joyce calls it, our own guidelines are sort of our own guardrails on all of this, and it's helpful at every opportunity we can to kind of have policy that helps shape that on the local level. And so many stations, as we said, draft their own guidelines, and it, mostly when they do that is to ensure that it does not influence content in any way, of course, being news organizations in many instances, and also to make sure that there would not be a public perception that an underwriter has exercised any kind of editorial influence. So I would say, Joyce, what do you think? I mean, most stations have their own local, regional guidelines in addition to what the FTC provides. Yep. So there's several layers there of insurance around making sure that the language fits the criteria and, again, provides those guardrails. Quick overview.
May I make a comment? Just since we jumped right into this topic, I just want to clarify that at this point, as I'm sure you're probably aware, Pacifica has had a policy and still has a policy that we do not accept any underwriting of any sort. And at this point, all we're doing is getting information about what underwriting might consist of if we were to consider changing that policy in any way.
That's right. Maxie briefed us before the conversation. Understood.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that in case some of the audience listening in are suffering some kind of shock right now.
Oh, we don't mean to shock. We just want to help you inform you and kind of let you know what else is going on in the landscape.
Background, I've studied some of the history behind this. You know, when public education, public radio, public television first came about as a result of some legislation going back, I believe, in the far back as the 1950s. It was actually conceived as a publicly funded stations, but that really never happened. Where you have such things is like in the UK, where they have the BBC, and there's actually a tax that funds the BBC.
That's right. Yep.
We didn't really have that. We had stations that were called public stations, but they were really dependent, for the most part, on listener contributions, not on public funding. They had some sort of public funding indirectly through things like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and so on. And even that proved inadequate, so that's how the underwriting source of income began to grow more and more.
So that's just some of the historical background in case people are not aware of it.
Yeah, and this is Max, if I may, Alex, another factoid, if you will, that I think is compelling is the British broadcasting model actually is much more financially robust than what's offered here in the United States. They're much better financed to perform public media, a non-commercial media, than we are. And so it's also one of the reasons why we've had to, I think, diversify our revenue structures in the way that we have to include underwriting and other things. So, but I also wanted to reiterate the fact that I did inform Joyce and Melanie that at present we don't have underwriting. And one of the reasons why I thought it was important for this presentation to happen is twofold. Number one, upon first coming to Pacifica, it became very clear in attending one of these committee meetings that there was a lot of misinformation being held by the members of our board about what underwriting exactly is. And there's a tendency to have a very hardcore understanding that it means corporate support. We at Pacifica, it's very clear we are an anti-corporation or anti-corporate organization. So the question becomes, how can underwriting be tailored, if at all, to not be considered a corporate exchange, but something that in the absence of that can be a mutual beneficial relationship between small businesses, foundations, community organizations, et cetera, in the local community, in partnership with the station. So that's one of the things I had asked Joyce and Melanie to discuss as well. Oh, and the last thing I'll say on that is it's clear we don't have a policy that endorses it, and that's absolutely correct. My concern is that we have had occasions where some of our volunteer programmers are actually doing a variation, unofficial and improper, of underwriting on our air. And so to me, I think it's important for the board to consider creating policy, even if that policy is an emphatic no by any means necessary, or some variation that says, if you do underwriting, these are the restrictions, and let the stations decide how they want to proceed. But regardless of how we proceed as an organization, I thought it was most important for us to proceed from an informed perspective. So that's why this call is being held tonight with greater public involvement. So, Joyce and Melanie, anything else you want to add? Are there examples that say of ways that stations are doing this to make sure that they have that firewall up? Are there so that the editorial content is not subjected to the financial support of those who underwrite? That is clearly a concern we would have. The other thing is, like I said, is are there examples of stations who have created underwriting with extreme limitation on who can underwrite that you can give us an example of?
So I'll talk a little bit about the first part of that, which is creating that firewall. In practice, stations actually distribute the written policy even as they're starting a conversation about sponsorship. There's zero editorial daylight in terms of where will your particular announcement be placed, what kinds of programming will it be placed in, all of those things. From the get-go are spelled out in writing in a policy that says those are solely the decisions of the station. In terms of stations sort of aligning with and finding the right kinds of local sponsors, as I mentioned, we have quite a few community licensees in smaller communities, and they will build a sort of a target list of the organizations, the companies that they feel are aligned with their mission and their image, and they will approach those particular organizations to be sponsors, to be underwriters. And they may not necessarily just publish a phone number and invite anyone in the world from any kind of company to call them and, you know, and expect that they can end up on the air. Do you want to add anything, Melanie?
No, I think that pretty much covers it in terms of that point. As for, you know, examples, I mean, thinking of one, so I'm located in Seattle, Washington, and one of the stations here is KNHC. It's actually located at Nathan Hale High School and it's licensed to Seattle Public Schools. They hadn't had underwriting on their airwaves up until, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, maybe a few mentions here or there for things, but didn't really put together a program for that until later on. And again, you know, that's one where they had to build things from scratch and really take those considerations into account, especially being associated with a high school, being associated with an all music station. In that case, it's dance music, which is, and also having student DJs as a part of the mix there. They do have a professional staff, but the students also fill in and do a lot of the shifts. So that's definitely an example of a station that took, you know, really careful consideration when putting together their local guidelines. But it also gave them a great opportunity because it was a really wonderful way to get involved in the community and share with local community businesses and organizations the story of the station. And I think that's one piece of this that's really important, too, is the storytelling part of what a great community service that station is, not only to the students, but to the greater Seattle area. So that in particular is one of my favorite ones to share about that, just because, again, the complexities of it, but yet a really wonderful message. And it's done well. It's provided capacity so that the station's been able to do more things and given them a higher visibility in the city as well.
Mansoor's here. I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
Yeah, Alex?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, thank both of you.
Mansoor, hold on. Who else wants to speak? Sure. Let's take this back. All right. So far, just you, Mansoor. Go ahead.
Thank you, Alex. And thank you, Melanie and Joyce. And good to meet you via telephone. And thanks for having Pacifica on board. A couple of questions. Besides best practices, what other trainings, techniques do you guys use? And you mentioned that underwriting is the second best fundraiser. What's the first one?
Oh, sure. So to answer your second question, membership and individual giving makes up about 38% of the pie on average, and that varies by market to market. But individual gifts make up the biggest piece of that. For the second part of our trainings, we have all sorts of tools.
What's the percentage of the underwriting?
Oh, 18%.
And where's the rest of it coming from?
So, again, 38% or so from membership or individual giving. Another 4% from national, state, local government funds.
And then there's philanthropic giving,
right.
Foundation grants, and, you know, other revenue.
Oh, yeah, we are horrible at those things.
It's also, you know, there's also, you know, that is an overall average, and it's important to recognize that some stations do get institutional support. If they're licensed, for example, to a university, oftentimes there is in-kind support provided by their licensee.
Okay, and besides best practices, and what other techniques and training would you be providing?
Sure. Well, we have three advisors that work in the area of underwriting for us. And they provide everything. We do a lot of webinars. We have materials on our website to help onboard new underwriting representatives or staffers at the station. The three advisors we have are available for phone consultations. That's part of Greater Public Membership. And they can answer all sorts of questions. They've done everything from building the policies we've talked about in the local level to probably our most popular offering is that we help stations make sure that their copy meets FCC guidelines for airing. And so all those things and so much more. And then we also have a conference that happens annually that provides training and networking opportunities for stations as well.
And do you have any trainings for board of directors as well?
We don't have anything formal. You know, we are tapped from time to time to meet with boards of directors and talk about our work and talk about basically the state of revenue in the industry. But we do not have anything formal.
Robin, for the
Sorry, thank you.
Uh-huh. You're welcome.
Okay, go ahead, Robin.
What are the costs of doing underwriting? Obviously, you have to have staff to process and recruit.
Yep.
I know a lot of stations pay a commission to a person to grow underwriting. You have 18% of the revenue, but what percentage of your overall cost is administering all that and soliciting all that underwriting?
Yep, yep. So the main cost, as you identified, is staff. Some stations do operate on a partial commission. Many stations, however, operate on a flat salary for their underwriting representatives. There's the costs associated with staff going out and having one-on-one meetings, but really it's labor.
But isn't there any can you equate, of that 18% you're bringing in, what percentage of that is staff cost?
Oh, I don't have that at my fingertips.
Can I pose a question a little slightly different, if I may? This is Maxie.
Certainly.
What's a healthy return on the investment in terms of your staffing versus what you bring in? For example, when I did underwriting in Baltimore, my sales staff brought in revenue by a multiple of 3 times what it cost me to staff them.
Mm-hmm. That sounds in the average range to me.
Right.
I mean, bear in mind most of that 18% and most of the 38% is paying for content, right, and for service. And so that it's actually a pretty low cost and a healthy return on investment.
Can you clarify meant by the content and the service?
Oh, certainly. In cases where stations are paying talent to host programs, if they're paying news staff to do reporting and build news programming, if they're a music station, they're paying talent to host their programs, they're paying, licensing fees and other things. So it's basically all of the expense that goes into having content come out over the air on the broadcast.
I have a question. Could you go into the different kinds of underwriting content that goes out over the air? And I know this ranges from simple acknowledgments of an underwriter to what is, to all intents and
purpose is really a commercial?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll let Mel jump in on this as well. The reality is public radio is much less likely to take advantage of the, quote, enhanced underwriting that you may have seen on public television, and you may hear on some, non-commercial stations on radio. By and large, it's purely descriptive, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, all of the things that Mel mentioned that are frowned upon by the FCC build a pretty clear set of guardrails for how to do underwriting that is not only on the right side of FCC's regulations, but also most acceptable to audiences. Anything to add on that, Mel?
No, and I would say, except that stations are pretty clear on setting the announcements for a certain length of time. It used to be they would be 30 seconds, but most of them are half of that now, 20 to 10 seconds, depending. So that's the other piece of it.
Yeah, and so that really does kind of keep you to a brief description.
Correct, yeah.
Alex?
Nancy has a question.
Yeah, I think, was that Carol?
Yeah. I think it would be useful, and I'm sorry, I'm so bad at remembering names, but the woman from Seattle, I think you're the one
hi.
Who identified
Melanie.
The, pardon me?
Melanie,
thank
yeah.
you.
Mm-hmm.
You're the one who listed the guardrails, the identity, not promotion, and so on. I think it'd be useful for you to repeat those.
Oh,
at least
sure.
for me.
yeah, sure, no problem. Stations are allowed to identify themselves but not promote commercial entities that provide general support to the station. Promotional language such as price, call to action, inducements to sell, comparative or qualitative information is not allowed. Political underwriting is not allowed. And stations are permitted to turn away an underwriter at their discretion.
Okay. I had one other thing, Alex, if I may, before Mansoor. Is that all right, Mansoor? okay. I think another staff issue is making sure that we're not taking people or organizations or entities that that we wouldn't like politically. You know, as you, I'm sure, understand that we're not a music station or a our mission is much more politically identified, and
right.
As you know, anti-war, as pro-justice, pro-civil rights, it's anti-poverty, and so on. So that the we're not looking for a general growth in audience, nor a general support from. Small local groups to the extent we might be doing this at all, since this is all in the context of we're not pro-underwriting, you understand. There would have to be staff that is seeing to it that we're not crossing lines in order to get revenue. And so that's another staff issue that may not be as important in some contexts. But in ours would be very important and a cost, I think. Just making that as an observation.
It's important in the context of any station doing underwriting, first and foremost. But I'll let Joyce and Melanie respond to it.
Yeah, absolutely. In many cases, senior manager is assigned to review any and all underwriting announcements before they go on the air. And if they have any question, they will often defer to the general manager of a station and or legal counsel. Right? So it's
well,
absolutely...
I didn't mean that they were crossing a line.
Yes,
you know,
understood.
In terms of those things, it would be in crossing a line in terms of who are these people and what do they support and what do they stand for vis-a-vis our values. That's what I meant.
Yep.
And maybe you want to speak to them.
it's one of the reasons why it's important, as Joyce mentioned earlier, I believe, stations have, in some situations, created a list of the types of people in their community that they would accept underwriting from. And they would actually target those organizations. It could be social justice organizations. It could be foundations that support some of the causes that we believe in. But they would target them and specifically go after them. Another model I should just mention, I mentioned this when I went around and spoke to the different stations. When I was in Baltimore, we did a whole emphasis on cultivating African-American-owned businesses in Baltimore, Maryland. And so we did a very direct case, if you will, to get some small businesses, particularly in the Caribbean community, to underwrite on WEAA. And we had programming built out that we thought would be in their best interest. And we were actually able to document how we were able to create some sustainability in the Caribbean business sector and actually help a couple businesses grow significantly in the time that they spent in our underwriting program. So it can be a very deliberate act and a very pro-social, pro-community act, depending on how you orchestrate the method.
Absolutely. And I just want to follow up on that by saying that, and it's all about your audience too, right? So you want to make sure that you are doing things and associating and working with businesses that go with the ethos of your audience. You're not going to go against that. And no one benefits from that. So I think in the stations that we know and work with closely, that's paramount to all conversations in this area.
That's right.
Let me follow up a little bit and play a little bit devil's advocate here, because one of the reasons Pacifica has always opposed underwriting, even though people claim there are various benefits and we don't have to cross any moral or political lines in order to do it, is because we simply don't trust corporations. We don't, and particularly we don't trust entities that claim to be for some of the values we stand for when we know that perhaps they're being funded, perhaps indirectly, by other entities that are well known to be against the values we stand for. For instance, there are a lot of so-called educational foundations that are funded by, say, tobacco companies or coal companies or things like that. And it may not always be obvious. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. And so we don't want to participate in any kind of greenwashing of corporations who are really against the environment, but throw a little bit of money to certain progressive organizations to make, you know, give them this halo effect. We don't want that. We don't want those kind of organizations to get any halo effect. So it's not always a simple matter to decide which entities you're going to absolutely restrict from any consideration and which you're going to support. Of course, it's easy to say that we're always for small businesses in our community and things like that. But the other question is, if we restrict ourselves to simply small businesses in the community, how much revenue could that realistically generate? Comment, please.
Well, I think it would depend on finding the right mix and making opportunities available at the right price. I guess I would defer to Maxie. But I think that even with modest rates for a sponsorship package, it can add up.
Yeah, I'll give you an example real quick, and again using my Baltimore reference. And the reason I bring that up all the time is it's the closest in my background to being at a community radio station where I ran it. But the bottom line is, I paid my development director, who did all of our underwriting. She was a former pharmaceutical sales rep, but she had a really gift for creating relationships and putting packages together. And she and I put this strategy together. All of our underwriting was done with small businesses in the Black community primarily. And I paid her well over my salary. She was making close to $100,000 a year. And she brought in well over $375,000 a year. Now, that's Baltimore, Maryland. That's only going after small businesses in the Black community specifically. Pacifica stations are in the top 10 markets in the country. And so the opportunity for us to do multiples over that is significant. And while we're very eager to get back in the good graces of CPB and get that money from the community service grant, I think per the percentages that were offered up earlier by Melanie, that we could probably make up that amount of money per station and more if we had successful and Pacifica-specifically designed underwriting systems in place.
Right, and I think one thing to add to that is having a policy and, having an overarching policy in place to address those kind of concerns about greenwashing, et cetera, is also helpful, too. And that's, one thing we were talking about. There's the FCC guidelines, but then there's the local guidelines. And I think having that, those considerations take into place, protect the ethos of who you are and who your listeners are pretty clearly.
Tom, for the SAC.
And Nancy.
Alex, we can't hear you.
Sorry, I was muted. Tom, go ahead. Then Nancy.
Yeah, my question is, what percentage of your membership are... actually, I have two questions. The first one is, what percentage of your membership are NPR stations?
Quite a few. There are non-NPR member stations that are members, but we also share pretty generously what we learn with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. As a matter of fact, Melanie is attending their conference in the coming months, and the vast majority of those stations are not NPR members.
Can you give me a percentage of each, please?
Oh, I would guess maybe something along the lines of 75 to 80% of our members are also NPR members.
Yeah, that would be my guess, too.
Well, the reason I ask is, actually, I'm an independent transmitter engineer, although I happen to be on a couple of Pacifica boards also. But my experience with the independent stations that I work with, a high percentage of those are Pacifica members that most do practice local underwriting, and the percentage that they're able to raise is usually between 3% and 5%. I know of very few independent stations that get that are able to raise much more than that.
Location, location, location. They're clearly not in major urban centers, and they probably don't have a dedicated staff for underwriting.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Do you have any more questions, Tom?
No, that's it for the moment.
Okay, I think Nancy had some questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for joining our meeting tonight. I had a question about how often do other nonprofits underwrite, radio stations that, would possibly be having our mission as the same as theirs. They're operating on a pretty small budget too, usually, and I guess the ones that might have the missions that we have, and I'm wondering, do they act as underwriters for programming?
Sure.
No,
go ahead.
No, you go.
Okay. I was going to list again. That's a huge part of the mix of stations that do have underwriting. And if you think about it again, like those top categories are education, so that's most likely nonprofit, performing arts and entertainment, again, likely that includes theater, other groups like that, and then nonprofits generally. So those are the top three categories. Right there of typical underwriters for stations. So we're not even getting into retail, which comes in fourth, healthcare, or financial services below that.
Alex, can I say something?
Yeah, we are running out of time, but let's give this a couple more minutes. Go ahead, Carol.
I have a question,
Nancy,
as well, Mansoor.
Nancy, I just wanted to say that I thought in the Bay Area anyway, one of the singular identifiers of KPFA is that we're part of a unique corporate free, and here it's interpreted as underwriting free, you know, that we're totally listener sponsored radio station, so that we have no strings on us. So I would guess that since that I think is true, that it's unusual for stations to not have any underwriting. And I think a lot of our affiliates actually, you know, have local underwriting from, you know, their communities and so on. And then the other thing I just wanted to add was, healthcare groups, I worry about the same way Alex raised questions about some places, and some education groups are really supported by, like, the Koch brothers and stuff. And nonprofits is a tax category. It's not a moral category, and the ones that we would be morally allied with, I think, are mostly pretty poor, I'm sorry to say. But I found the presentation very interesting, and I'm very glad to have heard it. Thank you.
This is Maxie, if I may just add a few elements to the last couple comments. I'm going to give you the kind of idea of the nonprofits that regularly underwrite, and I'm sure Melanie and Joyce can build on this, but it was mentioned theater companies. There are all kinds of performing art events. Like WPFW is a jazz station. One of our member stations is Jazz and Justice. Any organization presenting jazz in the D.C. metropolitan area would want to underwrite on the premier station in Washington, D.C.'s region for jazz performance. That's one example. There are schools that have speakers who come to town, or they're offering courses that might be in nonprofit management or getting an MBA program. All those kind of things that are, again, non-political. I don't think they have a moral compass, if you will, necessarily. are the kinds of underwriting that would take place. And that's happened at all the different types of stations I've worked at. And, of course, foundations. There are foundations that are it's easy to understand how they are funded. It's easy to understand what they fund. Their records are public, just as ours are. And oftentimes, those organizations are actually well-financed, particularly in major urban centers. And if they believe in your mission, they will find ways to support you through underwriting. And that's a win-win situation. So there, and those are just a few. But the nonprofit, as was mentioned, is a significant portion of the underwriting that takes place. And you're right about it being a tax versus a moral compass, but, there are a lot of like-minded organizations or safe spaces in that universe, to play with.
Okay. We are actually out of time for this item, but if anybody who hasn't had a chance to ask questions wants to now, I'll entertain that. Anybody else?
Mansur would like to ask a question.
Okay, this will be the last one then. Go ahead, Mansur.
So, do you guys help with grant writing?
We have a relationship with the Grant Center, which is more focused on public television, but from time to time does become aware of grants in radio and provides assistance with grant writing.
Yeah. I have one more. Could I ask this, Nancy?
Okay, go ahead, Nancy.
Sorry. How is the income from underwriting treated by the IRS? Is it different from? Is it taxed differently? Income from donors from individual donors? No. Because I've seen something in the FCC guidelines about you have to do reporting, special reporting on if you do underwriting.
I know that there's a category of unrelated business income that would be taxed differently. That typically applies when stations, for example, sell sponsorship on their websites that may not be 100% FCC compliant. It's then treated as advertising and would fall into unrelated business income.
So underwriting is not treated like advertising at all.
Correct.
Correct.